All right, I'm not going to say this is the last teaching we'll have out of Genesis, but I am bringing a close to our study for now. We may dip back in. I know, we're entering summer mode. So summer is like, we might do some stuff that, some more topical series, sets of two or three teachings here and there. I may take some of the time on Saturday nights to focus on some of the material and conform to his image and kind of catch up on some of that as well. So, it should be a little new surprise every Saturday. Keep things fresh. So I want to do tonight sort of what I did last week with Jacob's story, which is kind of give a big overview. Obviously, there's a lot of great stuff in this story that we could walk through if we went really slow. If we went half a chapter at a time, it would be a richly rewarding study. Another thing we could do is we could go through and look at Joseph's life and look at all the parallels with the life of Jesus and all the different ways that Joseph's, the way that his story plays out is very similar to the story of Jesus. And I'll talk a little bit about some of that today. But it's remarkable. I mean, there are tons of ways, tons of little allusions that we can find, little connections between Jesus' life and Joseph's life. But when we get to the story of Joseph in chapter 37, we enter a very different kind of story than Jacob's story. Okay, Jacob's story is unique, and it's complicated. It's difficult to figure out what's right and wrong. Everything kind of seems muddy and conflicted in Jacob's story. And that's kind of the point, is that it's a muddy, messy, conflicted story that God somehow breaks through to Joseph in the midst of and brings about his purposes and the line of blessing and the descendants and God's promise to Abraham continues to be fulfilled. And in all of these stories, we've continually come back to the idea of God's faithfulness. God says he's going to do something, and God does it. And people do all manner of different things in response to that. But God does what he says he's going to do. And in that, he is the faithful one. And as much as people get on board with that and respond to that and actually trust him, that's called faith. And God is looking for people to hear what he says he's going to do, believe that with everything in them, give themselves to it, live as if it's the reality. And those are the people through whom God can work and bless, bring blessing into the earth. The people who trust that if they walk with him, do what he says, stay faithful as he is faithful, that he is going to bless, bring mankind back to himself through the people, through the blessed people. God chose Abraham. He said, I will bless you. I will make you a great nation. And in you will all the nations of the earth be blessed. And God is, every generation, he is continuing to be faithful to that promise. Not just to the end of Genesis, right? All the way through to the Gospels, God is being faithful. To the point where, if you remember this, in Luke 2, when Mary receives the news that she's going to bring Jesus into the earth. And she says, be it done to me according to your word. When she breaks out in song, she says, God's being faithful to Abraham. God is fulfilling his promise to Abraham. Okay, so God's faithfulness is by far, I mean, the thing that this time through, I mean, and any time through, but this time through is keep coming back to God's faithfulness. Okay, so that's the same thing that we're going to look at in Joseph's story. But it's very different. God's faithfulness in Joseph's story works in a very different way than his faithfulness in Jacob's story. So here in the story of Joseph, this story is meant to show us God's faithfulness in his sovereignty over history. And but it's in spite of the various, in Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's life, their faith is more of a personal level, and God's working out, are they going to trust him? here in Joseph's story, God is faithful in the face of plans clearly meant to destroy his purposes. All right, evil plans. Okay, and so when we switch over to Joseph's story, it's not complicated morally. Okay, Joseph suffers injustice very clearly. These plans were meant for evil. Okay, this is different than cheater versus cheater in Jacob. Which cheater are you rooting for? I don't know. They're both cheaters. Okay, and that's complicated. But what happened to Joseph is unjust, and he suffers unjustly. And so we see God not responding to a person's struggle like Jacob, but God responding to powers that are outside of that person's control, acting upon the person. And God, in spite of that, being able to redeem suffering, to redeem injustice. Okay. So some big picture thoughts about Joseph's story. So in the big picture of the biblical story, Joseph's story is the bridge between the two major narratives in the Pentateuch, which is the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the Exodus. Okay, when we think the books of Moses, the five books of Moses, we're thinking about creation, you know, the first 11 chapters, those kind of are their own thing. The story of the patriarchs and the story of the Exodus. Okay, because everything else in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy are all about that generation and the one after that came out of Egypt. So this is how, when the book of Exodus opens up, this is how Israel ended up there. How Israel ended up in need of deliverance out of slavery in Egypt. All the way back in Genesis 15, God had told Abraham that as part of the prophecy, as part of the vision that he gave him in the covenant-making ceremony that he had, when he divided the halves of the animal in two, and the vision of the smoking fire pot that went through the center of the two animals, God said that you're going to be sojourners. I'm just going to read it here real quick. Know for certain, 15 verse 13, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and will be servants there. They will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. So, God had already seen this happening in his sovereign view of history. He had seen Abraham's offspring going down into Egypt and being there for 400 years and then bringing him out back to the promised land. That's why Hebrews talks about when Abraham, by faith, it says he was faithful to the promise, but he knew that it was a long way off. Right? He saw it a long way off and greeted it. But they were a far cry from, I mean, we got a long way to go before we're fully realizing this promise. And so God told that to Abraham. The story of Joseph is kind of a microcosm, sort of a little bit of a preview of what Israel as a nation is about to experience. Okay, so Joseph he goes down into Egypt. He's sold into slavery. He ends up in Egypt. But he ends up in prison in Egypt, in bondage, and not through any doing of his own. Right, it was because people, he was framed with Potiphar's wife, and he ends up in prison, and then he just kind of gets forgotten there in prison, and he didn't deserve any of it, and it was unjust. There's injustice at every turn. But the whole story is showing that hey, this man, God's able to bring him up, and fulfill his promises to him. In spite of all of the injustice, in spite of all the power structures working upon this man, God is able to come out on the other side no worse for the wear. God's purposes are. And that becomes the big moral of the Joseph story. So it's a micro personal scale that the Exodus is going to demonstrate on a national scale. That this big worldly superpower is enslaving these people unjustly, harshly. They cry out to God and he moves on their behalf and brings them up from their bondage. The second thing is that the story of Joseph is a key foreshadow of the way in which God is going to bring about redemption. Okay, you can't, it's hard to see, it's obviously the whole Old Testament points towards the gospel, but it's hard to see like specific elements of the gospel in Jacob's story. Like where is the, I can't really latch on to where the gospel is here. But in Joseph's story, it is the story of the gospel. I mean, we're in very familiar territory when we see the story unfold, Joseph's story. The fact that it's, you know, this is a guy who doesn't deserve this, who is rejected. He's rejected by his own family. And then he's subjected to foreign powers, right? And they both working in cahoots with one another. This is Jesus' story. I mean, it was the Pharisees and the Herodians conspiring with the Romans to unjustly kill an innocent man. That is the setup of the gospel. So it's like, okay, we can latch on to this now. But it's the idea that that has to happen. That rejection has to happen. And that's actually the means by which God is bringing about his redemptive purposes. So I do want to turn quickly over to Acts and look at the apostolic response to the events of Jesus' crucifixion, how they interpret it, okay? In chapter 2, verse 22, men of Israel, this is Peter speaking, hear these words, Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know, this Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. Jesus being delivered up was part of the plan. You crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death because it was not possible for him to be held by it. I mean, this is, you can see that principle at work in Joseph's life. Over in Acts, the next chapter, Acts 3, when Peter's addressing the men of Israel, he's saying like, guys, this is the story. I know you've read the book. You got to see the book in what happened to Jesus. Men of Israel, verse 12, why do you wonder at this? This is after they heal the guy in front of the temple. Why do you stare at us as though by our own power or piety we have made him walk? The God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. You guys know the story. Glorified his servant Jesus, whom you delivered over and denied in the presence of Pilate when he had decided to release him. You denied the Holy and Righteous One and asked for a murderer to be granted to you, and you killed the author of life, whom God raised from the dead. Verse 17. Now, brothers, I know you acted in ignorance, as did also your rulers. But what God foretold by the mouth of all his prophets that his Christ would suffer, he thus fulfilled. Right? He's seeing, I mean, when you are familiar with the Joseph story, you see, oh yeah, this is the righteous man is unjustly condemned, and God is able to, in spite of that, what they meant for evil, God was able to bring about good. That's really the whole story of the gospel. One final one in the chapter 4. They just keep interpreting it through this lens. Verse 27, chapter 4, verse 27. For truly in this city, there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel. It was his own people, and it was the worldly powers that conspired to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. And now, Lord, look upon their threats. And this is the cool thing, that the apostles here are experiencing some persecution as well. That's when they're saying this. They say, hey, we know that what Jesus experienced, this was according to your plan. Now, help us to face whatever we're going to face in that faith, in that trust in you, that you are able to redeem these things. Grant your servants to continue to speak your word with all boldness while you stretch out your hand to heal. Okay? So, really cool stuff there when you think about Joseph's story. That's exactly what happened to Jesus. And the apostles immediately knew it. This is how God does what he does. All right, number three. The story of Joseph. The other big theme, in addition to God's faithfulness in Genesis, is blessing. Okay? And the story of Joseph brings the theme of blessing in Genesis to its fullness. Okay? So blessing being God's rich, abundant provision to live the life that he has created us to live. Okay? Which is an abundant life. He's created us for an abundant life. And blessing is his rich, abundant provision for us to live that life. That's what was lost when mankind turned away from the tree of life and instead chose right and wrong in our own eyes, right? Our own judgment, our own verdict on life, what's good and what's bad. We're going to decide for ourselves, and that causes blessing to go away. In particular, it causes people to be driven out of the place where blessing is. So you must leave the blessed place. Well, there's too many ways to list the ways in which Joseph's story shows us how blessing works. God blesses Joseph. God blesses people through Joseph. God blesses his family. God blesses Joseph's family through Joseph. God blesses Egypt, the worldly power. God blesses the other nations of the world through Joseph and his family. God raises Joseph to positions of power. And literally, Israel at the end, the man Israel, Jacob, blesses Pharaoh. Talk about a literal fulfillment of, in you, in your offspring, shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. Okay, so we see this theme of blessing really come to a high point of fulfillment in this concluding story. Somehow my notes got... So this is back under number two. Let me just back up. My notes got somehow spliced. It's through Joseph's life that we see how, even in the midst of suffering and injustice, God can be present and at work to bring blessing. Joseph's own brothers and the power structures of the Egyptian Empire scheme together. Conspire together against Joseph. And that's where the Acts 2, 3, and 4 stuff comes in. But it says that God was with Joseph. In the story, God is with Joseph. In the Acts passages, we see that they refer to Jesus as the anointed one. God is with this one. God's presence is here. All right, and then blessing. And then number four. And this is just right in line with what we've been saying. The story of Joseph helps us to see just how able God is to bring about good in spite of evil intentions. It's not just that he can take a complicated individual whose motives are unclear and bring them to the place of total surrender to him. He can take what's actively concocted as evil against, meant to destroy his purposes. He can take that and do the, what's the martial art where you'd use someone's force against them?
Judo.
This is judo, right? That same exact, just like they said, you delivered up Jesus, but that was the plan. Joseph's went into prison in Egypt, but what better way than to raise him to power? Okay? Now, what the point of faith here for Joseph is that, okay, I got to look around and I got to see this doesn't seem at all like what's supposed to happen. And I got to believe that God is using this thing to actually bring about what's supposed to happen. And he does. The whole story arc, you see him, he goes way down and then he comes back up and he's then higher than before. And he's like second in charge in all of Egypt. And really saves the nation. It's an amazing thing. He saves the nation from the suffering of famine. It's his insight. It's his prophetic insight and his administrative skill that saves not just his little clan of brothers, but an entire nation. It's amazing. And, right, God is, Egypt is an evil nation. Egypt is a godless nation. And God is still working to bring blessing to that nation through his people. It's like it's the very same thing that Jeremiah talks about when the Israelites go into captivity in Babylon. He goes, it's going to be 70 years. Get comfortable and be a blessing to that people that are holding you captive. Because that's my plan. That's my plan. And so this gets us back to like the Romans. We've gone to Romans a number of times to see Paul's interpretation of these stories. But this one really puts us squarely in the middle of Romans 8, right? That God is able, God works all things together for good. It doesn't mean that God causes you to never suffer. It doesn't mean that God will make every day in your life better than the next day. What it means is that it doesn't matter what happens. God is capable of bringing about good through that thing. And in fact, the very worst thing that has ever happened, which is the crucifixion of Jesus, brought about the very best that has ever happened for humankind. That's how Joseph's story works. That's how the gospel works. It's very clear. Right? You don't have to wade through a lot of nuance. That is how God does it. What Satan means for evil, right? I'm going to bruise your heel, God crushes his head. It's been going on since the very beginning. This serpent tried to ruin things. Well, now we're going to judo the serpent. God weaves it together for good. I'll just read that, you know, at the conclusion of the Joseph story, at the end of 46. No, where is it? Is that in 50? Somebody help me out here. Where does it say that what you meant for evil? Okay, good. Thank you. Who is that? Joseph? Thanks, man. Fitting. Joseph has the answer here tonight. All right, yeah. Start in verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father gave us this command before he died." Now this is a little tricksy, right? they have the trickster gene passed down to them. Hey, Dad said before he died. Don't ask us to verify how we know that. Say to Joseph, "Please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. They're appealing to the boy's father, or the brother's father. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them, "Do not fear. Am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones." Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So it's a beautiful story. We see God's capacity to, and this is really kind of where we end up in Genesis, that all through history, forces are going to conspire, forces from within the people of God, forces from within the nations that conspire against God. This is Psalm 2, the nations conspire together. And God saying, if it's in-house, if it's out-of-house, I am able to use this. And in fact, the more you bring injustice upon the righteous ones, the more redemption I am able to bring. And ultimately, I mean, that's what Jesus is. He is the righteous one. He is God in the flesh. As they did it to Jesus, they were doing it to God himself. And he allows himself to undergo that so that they could see that even their worst does not keep him in the grave. Even their worst does not thwart the purposes of God. And the resurrection of Jesus is proof that God will always outplay the enemy. He will always outplay death because it's an indestructible life and you cannot kill the author of life. All right. So that's that, you know, that's Joseph's story. And it's a gospel story. It's a redemption story. It's a story for the people of God to say, hey, God is in control. And whether we experience peace and security or whether we experience deep injustice or persecution, God's purposes will come about. And we want to use our blessing to bless the people around us. And we want to, in the midst of suffering and persecution, be a blessing to the people around us and watch God use what is meant for evil. Watch him use that and turn that into good. We're going to prepare to come to the table, but I want to close. Got to close by reading some of Romans 8. What time is it? I feel like that went really fast. It doesn't really happen. What did you say? Didn't feel fast to you? Oh, yeah. Time flies when you're having fun. Yeah, so I mean Romans, I mean, we don't have time for all the context, but Romans 8 is all about this tension between what we know we're destined for and the reality that we experience every day. And we live to what we know we're destined for. That is the Spirit. That's the life of the Spirit. And that's the means by which we put to death the deeds of the body. We don't live to the flesh. We don't set our minds on the things of the flesh. And so let's start in verse 20. This can sum up a lot of the stories of the patriarchs as well, not just Joseph's story. The creation was subject to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation, so going back to Genesis 1, really Genesis 3, it's been groaning since Genesis 3. It wasn't groaning at first, it was singing the praises of its creator. Creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. Not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, we groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we are saved. In this hope we are saved. Now, hope that is seen is not hope. And this is where Joseph's story points us to the hidden reality of God's reality, the way God sees things. So much is in the story, and I didn't point this out, but there's a theme in Joseph's story of hiddenness and concealment. And the ultimate thing that's hidden and concealed in the Joseph story is God's redemptive purposes that are ultimately able to thwart evil. Who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. You think of Joseph in the prison, being patient. I don't see, remember the dream he had early in his life? I don't see this reality that I think was a dream from God. I don't see it. And yet, we wait for it with patience. Likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness, for we do not know what to pray for as we ought. But the Spirit himself intercedes for us with groanings too deep for words. When we are in this place of, I know what should be, I know what, and I see what is, and I can't reconcile those two things, that's where the Spirit comes in and helps us in our weakness. Because our minds can't comprehend. Joseph couldn't comprehend in prison, how is this a good thing? And this is where the Spirit comes in and intercedes according to the will of God. We know that for those who love God, all things, good, bad, meant for good, meant for evil, all things work together for good. For those who are called according to his purpose. For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. Again, this is Joseph. You know, he was sent ahead of his brothers to be a place of refuge and life for his brothers who did him harm. Joseph was a firstborn among his own brothers. Those whom he predestined, he also called, and those whom he called, he also justified, and those whom he justified, he also glorified. So what are we going to say then? If God is for us, who can be against us? What weapon formed against him will prosper? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things? Who shall bring any charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies. Who is to condemn? Christ Jesus is the one who died, more than that, who was raised, who is at the right hand of God, who indeed is interceding for us. Who shall separate us from the love of God? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword, all these things that can mark human existence, shall any of these things separate us from the love of God? As it is written, for your sake we are being killed all the day long. We are regarded as sheep to be slaughtered. No, in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am sure that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come. Some of you who fear the future, where the world is headed, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. Amen.